Welcome to The Week Ahead in Russia, RFERL's Monday podcast about significant developments and upcoming events in Moscow and beyond. I'm Steve Gutterman, and my guest today is RFERL senior correspondent Mike Eckel. Welcome, Mike. Thanks for joining me.
Good morning, Steve.
All right. One thing I'd like to talk about this week is how the situation in Washington with the impeachment probe, focusing in part on President Donald Trump's July 25th telephone conversation with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, might affect the prospects for peace in the Donbass. The other is the Russian opposition and kind of where it goes from here after the protest in Moscow yesterday. Mike, you wrote about the protest yesterday. You saw the reporting by Current Time and our Russian service and everything else. The NGO White Counter said, I think, almost 25,000 people showed up on a pretty cold and rainy day. It's a pretty big crowd, I think, for the first attempt to hold a major demonstration since the elections on September 8th. Of course, the main catalyst for the large protests in Moscow in July and August was the fact that electoral officials barred several independent and opposition candidates from the Moscow City Duma race in those elections. Mike, what do you think? Has the opposition managed to kind of regain momentum after that hiatus in protests? And where does it go from here?
I think the fact that so many people showed up on a miserable day is not something to be discounted. Again, it was about, I saw like reports saying it was 5 degrees Celsius and it was sporadically raining on a Sunday afternoon. And yet they still turned out 25,000 people. And to be sure, that doesn't appear to be a huge exaggeration. Moscow city authorities put the count at 20,000. So this is one of the larger such events that we've seen in the past 2.5 months of these near weekly protests. So it's not, it was a substantial turnout. And, you know, that's not to be discounted. Does it mean that they've regained momentum? I think, you know, it's a little too early to say. The focus of the protest on Sunday was political repression and freeing political prisoners. This, of course, refers to the people who were caught up in some of the protests over the week, over the summer, some of whom have been hit with pretty, I think you could say, disproportionately harsh sentences. Yeah. Pavel Ustinov is one of the sort of cause célèbre in Moscow. There's video of him strolling along the street talking on the phone. I believe it was July 27th when the riot cops just sort of storm like linebackers in an American football game and deck him, throw him to the ground. And he faced several years in prison, 3.5. I think there are news reports out today saying that prosecutors are seeking a suspended sentence against him. So I think what we're seeing is that, of course, Navalny and his allies are trying to shift the focus away from electoral results to a larger political discussion, political repression. And that, you know, that's a little harder for, I think, people to get their head around, you know, as part of a broader based political movement.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely think the Ustinov case, as you say, of the prosecutors today, I'm not sure whether there's going to be a ruling by the court on his appeal against the 3.5 year prison sentence, but prosecutors have asked the court to change it to a suspended sentence, meaning he would not be imprisoned. And I, you know, almost always that's the way things go, because the instructions would usually come from above. And it's possible that I think there had been a hearing last week scheduled, but they essentially postponed it until today, you know, possibly in part to kind of monitor what happened at the protest yesterday. You know, I'm not saying that necessarily had a huge effect on the decision. Possibly it had already been decided what to do. The wind seemed to be blowing that way. But I think the sort of the combination of the protest size, as you say, in miserable weather, and this easing up, at least in this specific case. There have been a couple others in which they've eased up, but I think none of the six who are actually also sentenced to prison, I think those six, aside from Ustinov, six prison sentences still stand, if I'm not mistaken. So we'll see if there are any more changes in that. But I think these things kind of show that at least the Kremlin is kind of under pressure to you know, make adjustments and kind of is kind of seeing where it's gone too far and where it needs to give in a bit. I mean, this happened, I think, in some of the local protests, some of the church construction in Yekaterinburg, apparently authorities realized that they, you know, were on the losing side and gave in. So I think these are kind of signs of that. But, you know, how big a deal it is in terms of, you know, how much pressure gets put on the Kremlin and United Russia and the government throughout the country remains to be seen. And we'll see ahead of the 2021 Duma election.
I think there's a deal of improvisational politicking going on right now behind the scenes on the Moscow level and, of course, within the Kremlin, within the presidential administration. And we saw that over the summer as well. How exactly are authorities, law enforcement, National Guard, and others, how are they going to respond to this focused, concerted push by a coalescing liberal movement, coalescing around Navalny, of course, but also figures like Lyubov Sobol, Azar, there are several others who have the charisma and who have drawn people along. And again, there's been this pendulum back and forth. Do the authorities crack down hard and start cracking heads and just sweeping people up and throwing them in jail? Or do they let these things run their course and hope that they peter out on their own? The Duma elections you refer to, they're 2 years away, the National Duma elections. That's a long time in any political cycle, certainly in Russia. So whether the opposition can maintain the momentum for the next, you know, year, 18 months, it's a real, real open question.
Absolutely. And it's sort of, all this plays into, you know, as I think you've written about, the question of what Putin is going to do about the 2024 problem when he can't run for another term when this one expires. So, you know, he may adjust his decision making, you know, based in part on how successful the opposition is. Is he going to try to co-opt them? Is he, you know, so there are a lot of questions, probably not too many answers. I guess just to move on to the other topic, which also has to do in part with Putin and Russia's future, but is focused more on Ukraine. There's been some progress in the past few months, or thought, or kind of a glimpse of progress in the Donbass and the war. It's killed more than 13,000 people since 2014. The war between Russia-backed separatists and the Ukrainian government forces. But now there's this very new element in it, which is the impeachment probe against U.S. President Donald Trump, which is focused in part or largely at this point on Trump's conversation in July with Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, in which Trump is accused by a whistleblower of having essentially sought to get Ukraine or the Ukrainian authorities to dig up dirt on Joe Biden, the former vice president, who is in the running to be the Democratic nominee to face Trump in 2020. So France and Germany have been the main players in terms of foreign countries in dealing with Russia and Ukraine and trying to end the war. But there's always talk of the U.S. getting involved, and the U.S. is obviously involved in many ways. In one way was that Kurt Volker, who's the U.S. special envoy for the conflict, essentially for efforts to end the conflict, he's now out. He resigned a few days ago. you know, in connection with this whole situation that's going on in Washington. So there's a lot of many people in Ukraine lamenting that he's out of the picture because he was seen as someone who's trying to get things done. So, to me, it seems like all these things where you have Trump under pressure over Ukraine, Trump in the past and presumably still under pressure to some degree over relations with Russia. Democrats are pushing for a release of transcripts of his conversations with Putin. So do you think, Mike, what do you think, is all this going to be another setback in whatever, you know, attempts there are to end the war in Ukraine?
I think Volcker's departure is pretty significant. Volcker was had institutional knowledge. He had been in that position for several years, maybe three. I'm not entirely sure. Mm-hmm. But he was seen as someone who was an advocate for Ukraine, and he was seen as someone who was a guy who could stand up and sit down with. First and foremost, with his Russian counterpart, which in the past has been Vladislav Surkov, has been the point person on for the Kremlin on Ukraine policy. Another gentleman, Medvedchuk, has played that role in the past to some degree or another, although now Medvedchuk and his political party are part of the Ukrainian political establishment since the parliamentary elections there this summer. So I think I would say that the Volcker's departure and the turmoil surrounding the Trump administration's policy in Ukraine, I don't think it's going to have a direct effect on the Donbass efforts to resolve the Donbass conflict. You have to remember that at this point, the war has been grinding on for 5 years. Like you say, more than 13,000 people have died. More than a million have been displaced. The Kremlin is sick of this war. Ukraine is sick of this war. The Europeans are sick of this war. There's this underlying pressure to try and do something, to try and figure out a way to make it a win-win situation. So that Russia can extract itself without looking humiliated, and Ukraine can extract itself without looking humiliated in the hands of the Russians. I think something else to remember also is Zelensky has a really, really strong mandate in Ukraine now. He's still wildly popular. He won the election in the spring resoundingly. His parliamentary the victory for his party in the parliamentary election was resounding, and the recent prisoner swap that happened just a couple of weeks ago, that has added to his clout and his ability to get things done and to negotiate from a position of strength. So I'm sure Zelensky and his administration are just, you know, fit to be tied about this turmoil in Washington and how that affects Ukraine's internal politics. However, I would venture to say, I'll go out on a limb and say, I don't think there's going to be a direct effect on, in the near-term future, on the Donbass resolution. Mm-hmm. I think the ball is still in the court of the Europeans, but also the Russians. You know, what do the Russians want out of this? Are they willing to come to the table and really, you know, stop leaning on or funding, fueling, supplying the separatists in eastern Ukraine and allow some sort of negotiated settlement? I'm not sure if that's the case at this point.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I think, you know, the ball is in Russia's court, and I mean, to some degree, in Zelensky's and Putin's. You know, I think in terms of Volcker's departure, you know, yeah, one thing is that he was quite critical of Russia. He was, you know, blaming Russia, saying the onus is on Russia all the time. So I'm not sure from Russia's point of view if his departure, you know, it doesn't necessarily, you know, deter an effort to reach a settlement. As
right.
You say, you know, I think they're sick of this war. And so I think for all the turmoil, Zelensky's kind of as his mandate may not change. It doesn't look like it's going to be decreased too much by this at this point. So I think, you know, it is kind of up to him and particularly up to Putin and you know what Russia wants to get out of this, which I guess is so you know maybe there's still a chance. Is it possible that Putin will see this as an opportunity? In which case, you know, that creates a that creates sort of a window for some kind of a you know progress. But on the other hand, as you also mentioned, there's the prospect of if Ukrainians see Kyiv as losing out or being humiliated, then that's a problem that could also be a deal breaker.
I think there's something else to remember is that the Zelensky phone call, the context for the Zelensky phone call was the question of this $300 million in military aid and security assistance that was being held up, allegedly, by the Trump administration, allegedly, as a way to coerce Zelensky to investigate Joe Biden and the energy company that his son sat on.
Mm-hmm.
There is strong bipartisan support for Ukraine in Washington these days. There's very little distance between the Democrats and the Republicans in terms of supporting Ukraine,
mm-hmm.
Particularly where security assistance is concerned. Javelin missiles, night vision goggles, counter-battery radars, the security assistance, the military aid that the Americans are providing, not the Europeans. The Europeans aren't providing the military assistance. It's the Americans
right.
that are providing that. And I don't think that's changing with the turmoil that we're seeing in the White House with the impeachment probe. So that's going to continue. And that'll persist throughout this this turmoil with the impeachment probe, the strong mm-hmm. bipartisan support in Washington for Ukraine in standing up to Russia.
All right. That's a great point, Mike. And thanks very much. Great to have you on the show. I think we'll wrap up for now.
Thank you, Steve.
All right. I'll be back next Monday. Meanwhile, please have a look at my Week in Russia article, which comes out on Fridays. Thanks for listening.